So I'm really excited to talk about the software that I'm helping to make, and it was so relevant to this conference that I feel like I really had to come talk about it, even though I'm super busy all the time writing my doctoral dissertation most of the time. So that's why this talk is not particularly, you know, nuanced in its preparation and such like that, is because I'm off in dissertation land most of the time, but I'm really excited to talk about it. Before I start, I just want to say that that last talk was awesome, and I'm really excited about that kind of work since I read about it on the internet a year ago or so. Ever since Maggie and I did our PSIGASM science dildo project a couple of years ago at ARS, which is what got us interested in this whole field, we were all focused on making just the sensors. We wanted to see what's going on inside our body while we're fucking, just to enhance our experience by knowing it. A lot of it's not conscious. So we're just getting the sensors. We got, you know, sensors that can measure how hard you're squeezing using pressurized bubbles and pressure sensors. And we had, like, the sonar, except instead you use infrared photons and jam it in your butt and you can see your heart rate and stuff. And
the research is in the book!
It turns out that biometric sensor stuff is really hard, but possible. And, you know, if we ever get another, you know, however much money to do some more research, then it might be able to be done without being a jaded engineering type. And, you know, all of these DIY projects can get linked together to a collective knowledge base, and people can actually make crazy smart dildos and stuff. And it's awesome that that looks like it's getting closer and closer to possible, not further away. So I just wanted to say that that makes me really happy. But now, I'm doing this crazy software thing. And I'm glad that this isn't that perfect, because none of my slides is all that interesting. But they remind me what to say, and that's useful too. So this is a piece of software, it's a tool, that will ideally help people report different kinds of abuse and harassment. And it's something that you can use in a specific community or networked group. So I'm going to talk about what problem it addresses, how it works, what it's supposed to do, a little bit about the implementation. I'm not going to go into too many details because this crowd probably, in general, knows a lot more about cryptography than I do. I don't need to be giving any lessons, but you can totally bring it up with me afterwards if you want to know what our plans are. This isn't my personal project. It's one that I've been, you know, commissioned to do a lot of the coding for. So the problem that it's trying to address is that a lot of times somebody experiences harassment or abuse, but if you come forward and report that, either publicly or to an authority figure, often there's a lot of lashback in various forms to the first person who speaks up, either from community members who want to protect their reputation of their community, from the accused person themselves who takes offense at implying that they're, you know, doing something wrong, or just from any other asshole in the community who thinks that making this accusation is slandering somebody. There are a lot of different ways in which this plays out, consciously and unconsciously, to punish the person who is the first one to speak up publicly about being abused or harassed in a workplace, in a sex space, you know, in an online community, in any different context. But after one person does find the courage to speak up, often later people, you know, then will come forward and corroborate this if it's something that's a pattern, which often turns out to be the case. And it's a pattern we see over and over, even in, you know, official studies, but also in certain, you know, just hearing about people's stories of the biggest problems here, that after one person comes forward, you know, very often the issue ends up being addressed through the subsequent accusations that come out from the discussion that it starts. And often, as a result, either the particular person accused is brought to justice if it turns out they were in the wrong, or the community as a whole at least addresses the issue in a better way, and there's some improvement to public good because that first person came forward. And even though there is a public good that came from that person coming forward, that person is usually punished in the long term, continually punished after the public good happens. So you want somebody to come forward for collective welfare, but there's a cost to that particular person for reporting it the first time, and that can create a culture of silence. Nobody wants to be the first to speak up because the first person gets tons of censure. So we want to find a way to, you know, maximize social welfare. We want to get the best good for everybody. So we want to lower the cost to an individual, a victim, from speaking up about their experience somehow. So the plan is what we call information escrow. So, you know, a normal escrow service is somebody who takes, you know, money or goods and holds them, a third party, while a transaction is taking place between two other parties. So, say, you know, I want to sell a sexy clip of myself having sex with somebody, and then another person wants to buy it. But, you know, they want me to make a custom clip for them, and I don't want to make the clip until I know they're willing to pay me. They don't want to pay me until I make the clip. Can get some third party to hold their money and then give me their money once I deliver the clip, right? That's an escrow service. Information escrow is to do the same thing with information. So somebody's holding that information safely until a certain condition is met and then releasing it. That's what information escrow means in this context. So the idea here is that victims of harassment or abuse would submit in some secure online form all the details of their complaint, including their personal information and the personal information of the person they're accusing. And that's securely encrypted at that point, and nobody can access it until enough other people accuse the same person. So if there's one repeat abuser against whom there are several complaints, you could, you know, set the threshold of complaints as necessary, or maybe have a complainer decide, I'm only willing to come forward with this if at least 3 or 5 other people do, then if everybody, you know, enough different people have filed complaints against the same abuser, all of those are decrypted and sent to an authority figure who can investigate each of them and take appropriate disciplinary action or make it public or do whatever is the necessary step. And that way no person has to stand up as the first person. It only comes to light when there are enough people on the same team, kind of. Just lowering the cost. And it seems like it would be a generally helpful thing for people, but, you know, we think, why the hell isn't it already there? And it becomes difficult in the implementation, and there's some, you know, as soon as we start actually coding it and thinking about places to implement it, who's going to sign on, immediately there are some problematic issues that get right into online identity, especially when it comes to sex. Which is why I felt like I really wanted to talk about it here at Ars. I'll come back to the details of the implementation. You obviously can't read this, but there's a complicated flowchart of what gets encrypted how and who gets to see what. The important things here are that we're designing the software to protect the accused... Sorry, I heard the opposite thing that I meant to say. It's designed to protect the accuser. The victim of the thing that this doesn't say. That's the thing I'm trying to say. Sorry about that. Yeah, so it's we don't care so much about protecting the rights and privacy of somebody you're accusing. False accusations don't actually, you know, do that much harm in the end, in the long run, from just based on studies of the harm of this kind of social welfare issue. It's the victims that are generally the ones whose complaints are ignored or who are stigmatized for making the complaints or generally discouraged from speaking up. So it's the accuser's information that we're designing it to protect. And, you know, we make it triple secure so no human actually has access to that information except the accuser themselves, until we match on the accused person's identifying information. So this is basically what I was just saying. We're protecting the harassed person, the victim. We don't care as much about the accused person's rights, although that's certainly something to do as well as we can. It's also important to think about whom we're protecting this information from when we're encrypting it and worrying about security violations. Certainly the person who's abusing, the person who's accused in this, would have some motivation if they knew that this was being, they were having a complaint lodged against them, they would have some motivation. But also, anyone else who might learn about the identity of somebody filing a complaint could consciously or subconsciously cause the person who's making that complaint harm. So that's a privacy thing, the accuser should have their identifying information safe from everybody for this to feel like a safe thing to use. The whole functionality of this program relies on the accuser person, the victim in this circumstance, being able to completely rely on the anonymity of their information until there are other legitimate complaints against the same person. And so that requires two things. You have to identify the accuser uniquely. And, you know, it seems like that's kind of invasive on the person who's the victim, the person whose identity we're trying to protect here. But still, because their information only stays anonymous until other distinct individuals have lodged complaints against the same abuser, that means false complaints or complaints by the same person could expose the identifying information of other accusers. If you have a spam complaint against Bob, and then I have a real complaint against Bob, and then there are three other spam complaints against the same Bob, then my complaint might be forwarded on without any other legitimate complaints next to it, thus putting me at risk. If people know that happens, then you have the same problem. They don't want to use the software. So you have to uniquely identify the accusing person in order to keep their information safe. And that can be difficult. You know, what if this happened in a BDSM context where everybody's using pseudonyms and you don't want somebody to give their social security number just to say they got touched wrong? Although, you know, the benefit in this case is that the accuser is voluntarily submitting this complaint in order to use this software. By deciding to use this tool, you know, they're participating. So you can ask them to do some task to verify themselves. But you have to distinguish them both from a computer or from somebody who's already submitted the same complaint and wants to submit a second one and pretend they're a different person. You have to make sure that, you know, you can tell whether somebody filing a complaint is the same as somebody else filing a complaint, and whether either of those people is a computer. Those are what you have to find out to determine what's a legitimate complaint. You also have to identify the accused person, because you have to figure out which complaints are against the same person. But the victim might not know all of the information about the accused person, and that person is not participating. You can't ask the person who's getting accused, obviously, to verify their email address. And you don't necessarily know their social security number when they touch you on. So you need some way to file a complaint and identify the person you're accusing uniquely so that other people identifying the same person will group those complaints together. So you have those two identity challenges to making the software work. You need to be able to uniquely identify the person who's submitting the complaint and distinguish them either from any other individual who might complain or from the computer. You also have to uniquely identify the abuser, the accused person, and distinguish them from anyone else who might be accused. You don't get their consent here. But we don't really care as much about distinguishing them from a computer, for example, because, you know, the computer's not going to be sent to prison for sexual assault. So how do we make the software work for everybody and actually serve its social welfare need, but still protect the anonymity that we like, either on the internet or in our BDSM space? Just because it has a social benefit, you know, we have these like two different conflicting forces where we want to be able to hold people accountable and, you know, identify repeat abusers so that we can, you know, improve our general culture of safety and making people feel comfortable expressing themselves, which is a big problem on the internet and in tech spaces and in a lot of spaces that like anonymity, that there are trolls, there are abusers who don't have a lot of accountability. On the other hand, we really like our anonymity, and it's really important to a lot of people's safety to be able to stay anonymous, especially sex workers on the internet and various people who are, you know, could come to physical, emotional, or financial harm from having their, you know, identity as a human shared between all the different spheres that they inhabit. You know, I've been doing porn at the same time I've been doing grad school, and if those two identities, you know, met completely, that could be a big problem for me. So places where I can stay anonymous seem really important to me. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that I should be able to have no accountability for my actions when I go somewhere I'm using a different name. And balancing those is one of the biggest problems in online identity right now, and it's one that I ran into head on trying to think about how to program the software, just to try to make people, you know, able to confront their boss who's grabbing their ass. I have to be able to uniquely identify them on the internet, and that makes me uncomfortable. So how do we, you know, this is like a concrete example of like social good versus like internet anonymity. That balancing it is not all that straightforward. So our solution that we're using in this project, which I'm not going to say is perfect, is not to identify a human uniquely among all humans. Think about, instead of identifying a person, like a human, like you might with a fingerprint and then a database that has everybody's fingerprints, imagine identifying one UC Berkeley student or one person at your workplace, so that you would have this tool only available within a certain network or community. You could have, you know, we were thinking of having a university like UC Berkeley license this software or implement it for free if it's open source, and then any Berkeley student could accuse any other person in the Berkeley network of doing this. Or in the military, where, you know, abuses and harassment are a huge problem, and reporting it is obviously very, the opposite of incentivized. Or on an online community like FetLife, where you don't want to link people's online identity to their actual identity. But if you implement this within each of those subgroups, then, you know, Berkeley knows how to identify a Berkeley student uniquely, because they give each person one Berkeley email address and one student number. You know, and the U.S. military gives every soldier a dog tag, and they can identify each soldier really well. And FetLife, everybody has a FetLife profile. Now, of course, you can make multiple FetLife profiles, but they won't all have, you know, the kind of social capital of having, like, some friends and activity or something if you just create five. That's a little bit more difficult in verifying unique individuals on social networks, but there are ways to at least start. But as long as any one of this network in which you implement something like this isn't all that global, you can still have a fair amount of privacy for, you know, you as a human. You know, you might know who I am among Berkeley students, and that has nothing to do with who I am off of my sex space. And it's a lot less invasive. So, you know, you could have different identifiers for different networks, where, you know, you don't necessarily have to know that the person who's slut boy on FetLife is the same as, you know, your Robert Smith, I made up. No offense to anybody named Bob Smith. And, you know, I have these identifiers in these different subgroups, and then the greater humanity identifier is some sort of biometric information. Now, that biometric information is one way that people could identify a person uniquely among all humanity, but that's only really the case when there's a global database of all the biometric information for everybody. Otherwise, you're not learning a lot. And once there is that network, then you have problems of who's in charge of it and how much does it know about you. And then that network that knows everybody by their fingerprint could probably figure out which fingerprint corresponds to Slut Boy and which fingerprint corresponds to Robert Smith. And this is what, you know, Facebook and Google are doing in the NSA. And that's where it makes me really uncomfortable. It's the global identification of a human. But identifying uniquely a human within local networks or within community networks is a lot less problematic, as long as nobody has a global database of every, you know, individual. It does create problems of who enters these subcommunities and how do we index them. You know, if you only want to let in people into Berkeley who have social security numbers, then that's a link between some sort of more global human identity system and a Berkeley identity system. And then a thing like FetLife, where you don't want that link, you have problems with people creating multiple FetLife identities for the same human. which usually isn't a problem at all, except that, you know, one human can get abused and submit complaints from three different FetLife profiles, and that's not how it's supposed to work. So there are still complications in this, but just because the internet links together all humans doesn't mean that every tool on the internet has to be applicable to all humans. In fact, trying to submit one kind of identifying system to every human being is what makes it really problematic, in my view. This is my diagram for what happens, you know, when the NSA spies on everything, is if they know everything you do on the internet, then those particular identities are no longer separate. Then, you know, the people who are tracking all of your movements that are supposedly disparate are linking them all. And so it's not just that the NSA knows that, you know, your slut boy and your private Robert Smith, it's that, you know, that might pop up on your Facebook advertisements. You know, they actually do use that information to invade privacy. And if they were tracking, you know, all of your internet movement, you might, you know, they might even know, even if they can't hack the secure form that you submitted, they might know that Slutboy on FetLife has gone to this complaint website a lot. You know, and the problem of tracking everybody's global internet usage starts to undermine the functionality of programs like this that are designed to benefit social welfare. I'm trying to get at, like, identifying an individual uniquely seems to be at odds with anonymity, but the kind of proximity, the locality with which you identify them, the subset of humans among which you're uniquely identifying them, can create some buffer between having some accountability for people and without having, you know, sacrificing all of our privacy. If we have complete identifiability among the set of all humans, then we lose the efficacy of programs like this. But if we have absolutely no identifiability, you can't identify a unique human even within a subgroup, we also lose the functionality of programs like this. So we need to have some sort of a community-based, local-based, network-based identification method to provide accountability in spaces like this without, I mean, okay, now I'm saying what we need to do. The NSA is watching us whether we like it or not. This is why I have a problem with this. But for identity, you know, my point in exploring identity through this project is that it's really important to have information security, cryptography, and identifying individuals, not just for privacy, but for public safety. And, you know, there are tools such as this one example of a tool that relies on the details of identifying people on the internet, of what information is kept private and what information is made public. Exactly who gets to know about my complaint is core to the functionality of this program. You know, somebody filing a complaint, even if they just suspect that somebody else might be looking in, that's an incentive for them not to file the complaint. So social welfare is generally maximized when the software works, and it only works when the cryptography works and the security works and the identity policy works. Compromising the information security of this program, even if you're only spying on the people who are filing legitimate complaints, undermines everybody's well-being. You know, certainly it hurts the person who's being spied on, but, like, if they don't get their information out there, it's not just them that suffers, it's the whole community for not having identified these repeat abusers and not improving the culture of shielding them. And identifying an individual among all humans is only a real thing when you have a database of whatever identifying information you're using for all humans. A fingerprint will tell you exactly who somebody is only if you have a database of everybody's fingerprints. Absolute identity is not a real thing. We always have to think about what subgroup we're identifying people within. And, you know, the U.S. government is trying to make, like, a global one, basically. and it's eating into a lot of the way that we identify with ourselves and how we think about how we interact with the world is the way they tie us to documentation. People who don't have documentation aren't thought of as real people. Between civil rights and human rights is not a big distinction in this country anymore, where if you don't have, you know, a social security number and you aren't documented, you don't have an actual identity. And that social security number is only an identifier within a subgroup of humanity. And there should be other identifying methods that don't have a barrier to entry. And you very quickly get that situation where you have to have ID in order to get ID, but if you had ID, you wouldn't need ID, right? You need to be able to have some of these networks in which you can be identified in order to be able to use software like I'm building, which you can enter without already having a verifiable identity. Because globally, in humans, there isn't actually a way to identify anybody. So that's pretty much all I had to say. I think the software that I'm making is really nifty. It wasn't my idea. I'm not going to take all credit for it, but I'm excited for it to be something that I think people will find helpful. But it made me think a lot about identity on the internet in ways that I haven't before. You know, I've previously thought mostly about anonymity as being something that protects me, but being able to identify myself would make me eligible to submit a complaint against a harasser in this context, and that's kind of the other side of the coin for me. And, you know, it brings up some interesting issues. I'd be interested to hear what people have to say.
Yeah.
Of course.
By the way, that's how our castration complex sounds. I hate that sound. I hate cutting sounds. Okay. So, questions for Ned. Who wants? Who's interested? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just came back to the NSA thing. Again, like, does it really matter in this case? Because, I mean, like, they're just going to be spying on us and, like, you know, if our names sound like terrorist things, they arrest us. You know, that's pretty much what that is. Like, and it's not like they're really sharing that information with anybody who... Well, I
know
that. Well, so, like, I wouldn't be worried about the NSA having my, like, the SSL keys to my Gmail, to Gmail, and thus my account and the things I write on those emails, right? Exposing me as a porn actor at the same time as being a grad student, right? Because they're not going to be looking at that. That's not. It was not even that they're not going to, but they're not. The community is not going to really care about that. Again, they're just looking for, you know.
What if you're doing something they do care about?
Then
like
you're
living
screwed.
Here without documentation or something.
What's that?
What if you're like living here undocumented or something
then
like
you're
that?
Screwed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm
and so then that's the sort of situation where then filing a complaint might be enough to get you deported.
Yeah.
Then you do care if
the
NSA is listening.
Yeah.
That is a huge problem with, especially the undocumented communities here in San Francisco. When they, once San Francisco and the General Bay Area became a sanctuary city, then a lot of the, you know, human trafficking stopped. A lot of, you know, rape, sexual assault, general assault, gang violence, drug dealing, all of that. The rates went down dramatically because they were no longer worried about being deported just by reporting a crime.
Okay, that's clear. Thank you.
There's the false positive problem where you haven't done anything wrong and you totally squeaky clean, but for some reason the data streams get crossed and you do get abused. And they do start digging in, and there's nobody who doesn't have a good job. Even the squeaky clean people that used websites before they were 18, or some random stuff like that.
Ah, I hate it.
Doctor?
So you mentioned that this is part of some project that's happening?
Yeah. I don't want to kind of, in case anybody who started it doesn't want to be identified in the context of a sex conference.
Okay, but like, what's the timeline? Is there anywhere we can find out about the line? Is it or is it
yeah.
Or like, how can we find out about it once it gets dropped or whatever?
It will be open source.
It probably will not in this implementation be open source, but they, you know, I don't think they can copyright the idea too well because it's pretty general. So, you know, I would encourage if I can't participate in an open source version. And let's see, as far as it's hoping to be, you know, programmed in a few months, implemented, it depends on when they can get some, you know, looking at particular networks who would want to implement it. You know, we're thinking of universities or the military to get somebody in an authority position sold on it to implement it there. That's if we were to have their permission. You don't need a university's permission to make this tool and make it available to their students if they have a publicly accessible directory, for example, which many do. So there are some questions involved in how we're going to implement it and where. I don't know if it's going to get a big publicity thing. Basically, I think this is like a law professor somewhere who came up with this idea and just thought it was really cool and is trying to get it going. I imagine he's going to want to publish papers on it and stuff. And at that point, I'll certainly publicize those. But I'm not sure how to give it a public presence now while respecting the potential privacy concerns of the people who thought it up. But I'm involved in the project. If you want to talk to me about it, I can certainly talk about how to get it implemented if you were interested in doing it in some community, or, you know, I could put you more privately in touch with the people who are doing it to get more profile that way without kind of announcing their names in front of everybody.
That's really good. The system, do you see a way for people to check if they have complaints logged against themselves? I feel like, you know, even if they couldn't see the identity or the details, it might... I feel like a lot of sexual... maybe not a lot. I feel like some sexual harassment can come back to ignorance and stupidity more than malice, and maybe having people be aware that at least something they've done has been flagged could be a useful thing for people to know. I don't know.
I could see the argument for that. I would be a little bit concerned about whether... you know, if you file a complaint after a certain night event, then it might be very clear to everybody who's filing the complaint. And so, you know, complainer might think of that as equivalent to, you know, telling their abuser that they're filing it, which could feel dangerous. But I don't know, it would be up for debate, I guess.
Maybe this is too specific, but for example, in the military, what if the abuser is the authority figure? Does that make sense?
Like the one who it all gets forwarded
right, like
to in the end?
You know, that person knows exactly who is saying all this stuff about them personally. Like, is there some information where it gets sent to multiple people, or the second that it, you know, five people all complain about the same commander, let's say, all five of those people are informed that that information has been released. Like, is there a way for them to, has that been thought of? Or?
Only in that we brainstormed ideas just like the ones you threw out,
okay,
which seemed like good ones. Send it to multiple people in an HR department, maybe.
Right.
Like, if it were military, maybe get, you know, the outside military investigative people who aren't on that base, you know, so that they're probably not interacting with these people would be a good idea. And certainly notifying everybody who filed a complaint when their complaint goes public, I think is definitely a feature that needs to go in public, even if public is limited
right,
to the authority people.
Right.
Did you talk about gaming the system?
About what?
Gaming the system? If there's someone I don't like, can I make up a case for them?
I see, so you're pretending to be somebody else.
I'm not going to propose any particular way to do it, but someone might figure out a way. What do you do?
Prank.
So you're worried about if we have a bunch of complaints successfully filed against somebody who's not guilty at all.
Yes.
Because, you know, falsified in some way.
Yes.
I would have to rely in that situation. I mean, certainly I'm going to do everything in the programming that I can to filter those out. But if that happens, then whatever authority figure presumably is going to investigate these and, you know, contact probably the people who are complaining, at least to verify that they're people in some private way. You'd have to have some kind of a human oversight at the end, I think, before publishing it in the papers or something.
First, a follow-up to his question, and that's the investigation process, you know, typically require Cannonball taking a deposition under oath from the complainant. So, you know, that's a way of you know, having a verifiable, testable way of making sure that the complaint is real. And then second is, my question is, like you said, the real barrier to complaints is being the first person. But in your system, you're hiding who's being accused until you reach the threshold. So nobody knows whether or not they're the first person or not. Have you done any, like, field anthropology with people who have made complaints before about whether or not this kind of system would encourage them to make that first report or be an early reporter?
I haven't. The people who came up with the system may have done more research than I have. But I think that the idea is that you don't want to be go public first. Even if you filed your complaint first, they're all brought public at the same time.
A lot of formal complaint processes, like in a large organization, include an anonymity process. Where you can say, I want to make this complaint, but I don't want to reveal who I am. And it's only the people who are investigating it who will know who you are.
Yeah, that's a fairly similar offline analogy, but it does rely on, you know, the humans who are taking those complaints, keeping all that information private, and doing all that identification and verification information I was talking about. They're doing the same thing as people in a lot of those situations, and if you have a really good HR person doing that work, it's as good as the software. Probably better. But sometimes you don't, I guess.
One more question. I think you... I don't know, like, some people already raised their hands up. You
I
don't know.
Spoke, so
okay. And,
so in some other contexts, in some computer contexts, in some peer-to-peer networks, the idea of having multiple IDs in the system, all of them represent people, is referred to as the civil attack, which is a reference to a classification of multiple personality disorder. And so there are a few countermeasures we have to the civil attack, but a lot of them are based on the idea of proof of work, meaning it takes some cost, a non-monetary cost, to establish an identity in the system.
Right, okay. Yeah, so that would be a way to, like, your FetLife profile has to have been active for 3 months and posted a bunch of things before your complaint. I don't know, because that takes work.
Okay,
some example like that. Yeah, that could be a good way to make your identity, anybody able to establish an identity, but still make sure that it's a legitimate person who's not establishing 10 or something. Then at least it would take a lot of work to make a bunch of false complaints, which would ultimately be thrown out anyway when you try to get depositions if you're doing that. So, yeah, it seems like a reasonable idea, depending on how exactly it's implemented. Because I imagine if I were trying to sell this to the U.S. military, I would talk a lot of different details of implementation and what happens than if I'm talking to FetLife, right? Different consequences if something, you know, if a complaint's accepted, different identification information, you know. So in the different networks, you can have very different rules for these things, which is another reason not to do it globally.
One last. Okay.
My question surrounds the many to one, as happens in the military more frequently. You have many people in some sort of an authority position, and only one accused or one harassed. How would your system be able to deal with that if you had one person who had all these complaints? and very few other people are experiencing
that. It's a good question. I hadn't thought about that situation too much. I guess the software wouldn't really be useful if you're the only person who's had this experience. But if there's a group of authority figures who are repeatedly doing the victimizing multiple people in series, I could imagine having some sort of a way to file a complaint against a group or, you know, I don't know, the military could be the commanders at base blank or something like that. I'd have to think about the details, though. That does sound like it's something that's probably happens a fair amount and could potentially be addressed by this.
And in the military, it's particularly tricky because they move every 1 to 3 years.
Right.
So it's very short-lived.
Thank you, Ned. Wonderful. Thank you. Wonderful. Yay. Okay.